Hi there. Welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast. It's lovely to be speaking to you again for my second installment of this revitalized, renewed version of podcast I've been keeping up off and on since 2006. And I'm going to be reading to you today some more from my Sturgeon Award-winning novella, The Man Who Sold the Moon. But before I do, a little bit of news about what's coming up. The first is that the UK paperback of my novel Walkaway is now out and in stores, and it's beautiful. And if you're in the UK or Australia or New Zealand or in continental Europe, you can pick up a copy for yourself. It's a beautiful little trade paperback. And those of you in Australia and New Zealand, I'll be seeing you from February 23rd to March 13th. I'll be touring about 9 or 10 cities in the region. I continue to work apace on my novel Crypto Wars, which is the third Little Brother novel for adults, and on the short story Model Minority that I'm hoping to be done with in maybe about 2-3 weeks. And in case any of you are headed to the World Science Fiction Convention this year, or if you went last year and you're eligible to nominate for the Hugo Award, this is your weekly reminder that the novel Walkaway is eligible in the Best Novel category and has done very well so far. Won a Dragon Award for Best Dystopian Novel back in the autumn as well. If you're in Los Angeles, I will be at AppSec California in Santa Monica on January the 31st. And then headed down a bit to UCSD on February the 9th if you're in San Diego. I'll be back in LA on March the 15th to interview Jen Wang, my collaborator on the graphic novel In Real Life. Jen has a new graphic novel out called The Prince and the Seamstress that is astounding, and I'll be hosting her. And then those of you in my homeland of Canada, I'll be at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo around May the 9th, and I hope to see you there. More details as I have them. And I guess the other thing I should mention is if you like listening to audio of my books, or if you like reading my books, you should know that all of my books are available for sale on my website, craphound.com/shop, as well as the audiobooks, including a very, very good audiobook of Walkaway read by, among others, Will Wheaton, Buffy's Amber Benson, Amanda Palmer from Dresden Dolls, and many other diverse hands. And it is available without DRM, as are all of my other books. And it's available without any kind of license agreement. So you don't have to click through anything and agree to give anything up in order to read that book or listen to it. So I hope you will support your local starving artist and the publishers that support me. When you buy from me, I get the cut that Amazon would normally take, which is about 25%. And then I send the rest of the money back to my publisher, and then they take 25% of that and send it back to me as my royalty. So I effectively double my royalty rate if you buy from me as opposed to from Amazon or any of the other retailers. So if you're thinking about getting any of those books, that's the way to do it. All right, let us move on to today's reading. This is part 2 of The Man Who Sold the Moon. Pug had a cooler between us, full of energy beverages, an electrolyte drink, jerky, and seed bars. We stopped in Mono Lake and bought bags of oranges from old guys at the side of the road wearing cowboy hats, and later on we stopped at a farm stall and bought fresh grapefruit juice that stung with tartness and was so cold that the little bits of pulp were little frost bombs that melted on our tongues. Behind us, in the van's cargo area, was everything we needed for a long weekend of hardcore radical self-reliance. Water cans to fill in Reno, solar showers, tents, tarps, rebar stakes, booze, bikes, sunscreen, first aid kits, a shotgun, an air cannon, a flamethrower, various explosives, crates of fireworks, and more booze, all stored and locked away in accordance with the laws of both California and Nevada, as verified through careful reference to a printout sheathed in plastic paper saver that got Velcroed to the inside of the van's back door when we were done. In the center of all this gear, swaddled in bubble wrap and secured in place with multiple tie-downs, was the gadget, which we'd given a capital letter to in our emails and messages. The gadget. I talked Pug out of some of his aversion to moving parts, because the gadget was going to end up drowning in its own output if we didn't. The key was the realization that it didn't matter where the gadget went so long as it went somewhere, which is how we ended up in Strand Beast territory. The Strand Beast is an ingenious wind-powered walker that looks like a blind mechanical millipede. Its creator, a Dutch artist named Theo Janssen, designed it to survive harsh elements and to be randomly propelled by the wind. Ours had a broad back where the gadget's business end perched, and as the yurt panels were completed, they'd slide off to land at its feet, gradually hemming it with rising piles of interlocking, precision-printed pieces. To keep it from going too far afield, I'd tether it to a piece of rebar driven deep into the playa, giving it a wide circle through which the harsh winds of the Black Rock Desert could blow it. Once I was done, Pug had to admit I'd been right. It wasn't just a better design, it was a cooler one, and the gadget had taken on the aspect of a centaur, with the printer serving as rising torso and head. We'd even equipped it with a set of purely ornamental goggles and a filter mask, just to make it fit in with its neighbors on the playa. They were a very accepting lot, but you never knew when anti-robot prejudice would show its ugly head, so anything we could do to anthropomorphize the gadget would only help our cause. Pug's busted arm was healed enough to drive to the Nevada line, but by the time we stopped for gas, he was rubbing at his shoulder and wincing, and I took over the driving, and he popped some painkillers, and within moments he was fast asleep. I tried not to envy him. He'd been a bundle of nerves in the run-up to the fourth, despite several successful trial runs in his backyard, and a great demo on the roof of Minas. He kept muttering about how nothing ever worked properly in the desert, predicting dire all-nighters filled with cursing and scrounging for tools and missing the ability to grab tech support online. It was a side of him I hadn't seen up to that point. He was normally so composed, but it gave me a chance to be the grown-up for a change. It helped once I realized that he was mostly worried about looking like an idiot in front of his once-a-year friends, the edgiest and weirdest people in his set. It also hadn't escaped my notice that he, like me, was a single guy who spent an awful lot of time wondering what this said about him. In other words, he didn't want to look like a dork in front of the eligible women who showed up. I'm guessing 2 more hours to Reno, then we'll get some last-minute supplies and head out, unless you want to play the slots and catch a Liza Minnelli impersonator. No, I want to get out there and get set up. Good. Suddenly, he gorilla beat his chest with his good fist and let out a rebel yell. Man, I just can't wait. I smiled. This was the voluble Pug I knew. He pointed a finger at me. Oh, I see you smiling. You think you know what's going to happen. You think you're going to go drink some beers, eat some pills, blow stuff up, and maybe get lucky. What you don't know is how life-changing this can all be. You get out of your head, literally, it's like... He waved his hands, smacked the dashboard a couple of times, cracked and swigged an energy beverage. Okay, this is the thing. We spend all our time doing, you know, stuff. Maintenance. 98% of the day, all you're doing is thinking about what you're going to be doing to go on doing what you're doing. Worrying about whether you've got enough socked away to see you through your old age without ending up eating cat food. Worry about whether you're getting enough fiber or eating too much carbs. It's being alive, but it's hardly living. You ever been in a bad quake? No? Well, here's the weird secret of a big quake. It's actually pretty great afterwards. I mean, assuming you're not caught in the rubble, of course. After a big one, there's this moment, a kind of silence, like you were living with this huge old refrigerator compressor humming so loud in the back of your mind that you've never, ever been able to think properly, not once since the time you turned, you know, 11 or 12, maybe younger. Never been present and in the moment. And then that humming refrigerator just stops. And there's a ringing, amazing, all-powerful silence, and for the first time, you can hear yourself think. There's that moment, after the earth stops shaking, when you realize that there's you and there's everyone else, and the point of it all is for you to figure out how to get along together as best as you can. They say that after a big one, people start looting, raping, eating each other, whatever. But you know what I saw the last time it hit, back in 2019? People figuring it out, firing up their barbecues and cooking dinner for the neighborhood with everything in the freezer, before it spoils anyway. Kids being looked after by everyone, everyone going around and saying, what can I do for you? Do you have a bed, water, food? You okay? Need someone to talk to? Need a ride? In the movies, they always show everyone running around and looting as soon as the lights go out, but I can't say as I've ever seen that. I mean, that's not what I'd do, would you? I shook my head. Course not. No, we know would, because we're on the same side, the human race's side. But when the fridge is humming away, you can lose track of that, start to feel like it's zero sum, a race to see who can squirrel away the most nuts before the winter comes. When a big shaker hits, though, you remember that you aren't the kind of squirrel who could live in your tree with all your nuts while all the other squirrels starved and froze out there. The Playa is like a disaster without the disaster. It's a chance to switch off the fridge and hear the silence. A chance to see that people are, you know, basically awesome, mostly. It's the one place where you can actually confront reality instead of all the noise and illusion. So you're basically saying that it's like Buddhism with recreational drugs and explosions? Basically. We rode a while longer. The signs for Reno were coming more often now, and the traffic was getting thicker, requiring more attention. If only, he said, if only there was some way to feel like that all the time. You couldn't, I said, without thinking. Regression to the mean. The extraordinary always ends up feeling ordinary. Do it for long enough, it'd just be noise. You may be right, but I hope you're not. Somewhere out there, there's a thing so amazing that you can devote your life to it and never forget how special it is. We crawled the last 30 miles, driving through Indian country, over cattle gratings and washed out gullies. The local cops are fine, they're practically burners themselves. Everyone around here grew up with Burning Man, and it's been the only real source of income since the gypsum mine closed. But the feds and the cops from over the state line, they're bad news. A lot of Jack Mormons over in Pershing County don't like this at all. And since this whole route to the Playa, apart from the last quarter mile, is in Washoe County, and since no one's supposed to buy or sell anything once you get to the Playa, all the money stays in Washoe County, and Pershing gets none of it. All they get are the freaks who offend them to their very souls. So basically, you want to drive slow and keep your nose clean around here, because you never know who's waiting around a bush to hand you a giant ticket and search your car down to the floor mats. I slowed down even more. We stopped for Indian tacos, fried flatbread smothered in ground beef and fried veggies, that sat in my stomach in an undigestible, salty lump. Pug grew progressively more manic as we approached the turnoff for Black Rock Desert and was practically drumming on the dashboard by the time we hit the dusty, rutted side road. He played with the stereo, put on some loud electronic dance music that made me feel old and out of it, and fished around under the seat for a dust mask and a pair of goggles. I'd seen lots of photos of Burning Man, the tents and the shade structures and RVs and mutant vehicles stretching off in all directions. And even though I knew the 4th was a much smaller event, I'd still been picturing that in my mind's eye. But instead, what we saw was a seemingly endless, empty desert, edges shrouded in blowing dust clouds with the hints of mountains peeking through, and no sign at all of human habitation. "Now where?" I said. He got at his phone and fired up a GPS app, clicked on one of his waypoints, waiting a moment, and then pointed into the heart of the dust. "That way." We rumbled into the dust cloud and soon were in a near-total whiteout. I slowed the car to walking pace, and then slower than walking pace. "Pug, we should just stop for a while," I said. "There's no roads. Cars could come from any direction." "All the more reason to get to the campsite," he said. "We're sitting ducks out here for anyone arriving." "It's not really logic," I said. "If we're moving and they're moving, we've got a much better chance of getting into a fender bender than if we're staying still." The air in the van tasted dusty and alkali. I put it in park and put on the mask, noticing my eyes were starting to sing, and added goggles, big, bug-eyed Soviet-era MIG goggles. "Drive," he said. "We're almost there." I was starting to catch some of his enthusiasm. I put it back into drive and rode the brakes as we inched through the dust. He peered at his GPS, calling out left, then straight, then right, and back again. A few times I was sure I saw a car bumper or a human looming out of the dust before us and slammed on the brakes, only to discover that it had been a trick of the light and my brain's overactive, nerve-racked pattern-matching systems. When I finally did run something over, I was stretched out so tight that I actually let out a scream. In my defense, the thing we hit was a tent peg made out of rebar. The next 5 days gave the chance to become endlessly acquainted with rebar tent pegs, which didn't scar the Playa and were cheap and rugged, pushing it through the front driver's side tire, which exploded with a noise like a gunshot. I turned off the engine and tried to control my breathing. Pug gave me a moment, then said, "We're here!" "Sorry about the tire." "We're gonna wreck stuff that's a lot harder to fix than a flat tire. You think we can get to the spare without unpacking?" "No way." "Then we'll have to unpack. Come on, buddy." The instant he opened the door, a haze of white dust followed him, motes sparkling in the air. I shrugged and opened my door and stepped out into the dust. There were people in the dust, but they were ciphers, masked, goggled, indistinct. I had a job to do, clearing out the van's cargo and getting it moved to our site, which was weirdly precise, a set of four corners defined as GPS coordinates that ran to the tenth of a second, and at the same time such a farcically huge tract of land that it really amounted to, oh, anywhere over there is fine. The shadowy figures came out of the dust and formed a bucket brigade, into which I vanished. I love a good bucket brigade, but they're surprisingly hard to find. A good bucket brigade is where you accept your load, rotate 180 degrees, and walk until you reach the next person, load that person, do another Voltfoss, and walk until someone loads you. A good bucket brigade isn't just passing things from person to person. It's a dynamic system in which autonomous units bunch and debunch as is optimal given the load and the speed and energy levels of each participant. A good bucket brigade is a thing of beauty, something whose smooth coordination arises from a bunch of disjointed parts who don't need to know anything about the system's whole state in order to help optimize it. In a good bucket brigade, the mere act of walking at the speed you feel comfortable with and carrying no more than you can safely lift and working at your own pace produces a perfectly balanced system in which the people faster than you can work faster and the people slower than you can work slower. It's the opposite of an assembly line, where one person's slowness is the whole line's problem. A good bucket brigade allows everyone to contribute at their own pace, and the more contributors you get, the better it works. I love bucket brigades. It's like proof that we can be more together than we are on our own, and without having to take orders from a leader. It wasn't until the van was empty, and I pulled a lounger off our pile of gear and set it up and sank down into it, that I realized that an hour had slipped by, and I was both weary and energized. Pug handed me a flask, and I sniffed at it, got a noseful of dust and whiskey fumes, and then sipped at it. It was Kentucky bourbon, and it cut through the dust in my mouth and throat like oven cleaner. Pug sprawled in the dust beside me, his blonde hair splayed up around his head like a halo. "Now the work begins," he said. "How you holding up?" "Ready and willing, Captain," I said, speaking with my eyes closed and my head flung back. "Look at you two," an amused female voice said. Fingers plucked the flask out of my hands. I opened my eyes. Standing over us was a tall, broad-shouldered woman whose blue mohawk was braided in a long rope that hung over her shoulder. "You just got here and you're already pooped. You're an embarrassment to the uniform." "Hi, Blight," Pug said, not stirring. "Blight, this is Greg. He's never been to the playa before." "A virgin," she said, "my stars and garters." She drank more whiskey. She was wearing overalls with the sleeves ripped off, showing her long, thick, muscled arms, which had been painted with stripes of zinc like a barber pole. It was hard to guess her age. The haircut suggested mid-20s, but the way she held herself and talked made me think she might be more my age. I tried not to consider the possibilities of a romantic entanglement. As much as a hormone fest as the playa was supposed to be, it wasn't summer camp. "We'll be gentle," she said. "Don't worry about me," I said. "I'm just gathering my strength before leaping into action. Can I have the whiskey back, please?" She drank another mouthful and passed it back. "Here you go. That's good stuff, by the way." "Fighting cock," Pug said. "I bought it for the name, but stayed for the booze." He got to his feet, and he and Blight shared a long hug. His feet left the ground briefly. "Missed you, Pug." "Missed you, too. You should come visit sometime." They chatted a little, like old friends, and I gathered that she lived in Salt Lake City and ran a goth alternative dance club that sounded familiar. There wasn't much by way of freak culture out in SLC, but wherever there was quickly became legendary. I'd worked with a guy from Provo, a gay guy who'd never fit in with his Mormon family, who'd spent a few years in SLC before coming to LA. I was pretty sure he'd talked about it, a kind of way station for Utah's underground Bohemian Railway. Then Pug held his hand out to me and pulled me to my feet and announced that we'd be setting up camp. This involved erecting a giant shade structure, stringing up hammocks, and laying out the heavy black rubber solar shower bladders on the van's roof to absorb the day's heat, setting out the grill and the bags of lump charcoal, and hammering hundreds of lengths of bent-over rebar into the unyielding desert floor. Conveniently, Pug's injured arm wasn't up to the task, leaving me to do most of the work, though some of the others pitched in at the beginning until some more campers arrived and needed help unloading. Finally, it was time to set up the gadget. I'd been worried about it, especially as we'd bashed over some of the deeper ruts after the turnoff onto Route 34, but Pug had been awfully generous with the bubble wrap. I ended up having to scrounge a heavy ammo box full of shotgun shells to hold down the layer after layer of plastic and keep it from blowing away. I drew a little crowd as I worked. Now they weren't too busy. And Blight stepped in and helped toward the end, bundling up armloads of plastic sheeting and putting it under the ammo box. Finally, the many-legged gadget was fully revealed. There was a long, considering silence that broke when a breeze blew over it and it began, very slowly, to walk as each of the leg's sails caught the wind. It clittered along on its delicate feet and then, as the wind gusted harder, lurched forward suddenly, scattering the onlookers. I grabbed the leash I'd clipped to its rear and held onto it as best as I could, nearly falling onto my face before I reoriented my body to lean away from it. It was like playing one-sided tug-of-war. I whooped, and then there were more hands on the leash with mine, including Blight's, and we steadied it. "Guess I should have driven a spike for the tether before I started," I said. "Where are you going to spike it?" Blight asked. I shrugged as best as I could while still holding the strong nylon cable. "I don't know. Close enough to the shade structure that we can keep tools and gear there while we're working on it, but far enough away that it can really get around without bashing into anything." "Stay there," she said, and let go, jogging off toward the back 40 of our generous plot. She came back and grabbed our sledgehammer and one of the longest pieces of rebar, and I heard the ringing of a mallet on steel, sure, rhythmic strokes. She'd done this a lot more than me. She jogged back a moment later, with her goggles pushed up on her forehead, revealing dark brown eyes, wide set, with thick eyebrows and fine crow's feet. The part of me that wasn't thinking about the gadget was thinking about how pretty she was, and wondering if she was single, and wondering if she was with Pug, and wondering if she was into guys at all anyway. "Let's get it tied off," she said. We played out the rope and let it drag us toward the rebar she'd driven nearly all the way into the hard pack, the bent double tips, both buried deep, forming a staple. I threaded the rope's end through and tied a sailor's knot I'd learned in the 1 week I'd attended scouts when I was 9, the only knot I knew. It had never come loose. If it came loose this time, there was a chance the gadget would sail all the way to Reno over the coming months, leaving behind a trail of interlocking panels that could be forbed into a yurt. The sun was starting to set, and I really wanted to go through my maintenance checklist for the gadget. There was dance music playing, dubstep. I'd been warned by Pug in advance, and had steeled myself to learning to love the wub, wub, wub. There were people milling about. There was the smell of barbecue. The sun was a huge, bloody red ball on the horizon, and the heat of the day was giving way to a perfectly cool night. Laser light played through the air. Drones flew overhead, strobing with persistence of vision LED light shows and doing aerobatics that pushed their collision avoidance routines to the limit. Every time one buzzed me, I flinched, as I had been doing since the accident. Blight dusted off her hands on her thighs. "Now what?" I looked around. "Dinner?" "Yeah," she said, and linked arms with me and led me back to camp. Sometime around midnight, I had the idea that I should be getting to bed and getting a good night's sleep so that I could get the gadget up and running in the morning. Then Pug and I split a tab of E and passed a thermos full of mushroom tea back and forth, a hippie flip, something I hadn't tried in more than a decade, and an hour later I was dancing my ass off and the world was an amazing place. I ended up in a wonderful cuddle puddle around 2 a.m., every nerve alive to the breathing chests and the tingling skin of the people around me. Someone kissed me on the forehead and I spun back to my childhood, and the sensation of having all the time in the world and no worries about anything flooded into me. In a flash, I realized that this is what a utopian post-scarcity world would be like, a world where there was no priority higher than pleasing the people around you and amusing yourself. I thought of all those futures I'd read about and seen, places where everything was built atop sterile metal and polymer. I'd never been able to picture myself in those futures. But this future, a dusty, meaty world where human skin and sweat and hair were all around, but so were lasers and UAVs and freaking wind-walking robots, that was a future I could live in. A future devoted to pleasing one another. "Welcome to the future," I said into the hollow of someone's throat. That person chuckled. The lasers lanced through the dust overhead, clean, multicolored beams sweeping the sky. The drones buzzed and dipped. The moon shone down upon us, as big as a pumpkin and as pale as ancient bone. I stared at the moon. It stared back. It had always stared back, but I'd always been moving too quickly to notice. Well, that's a very good place to stop, and it was lovely to come back and talk to you again. And I'm planning to do it again in 2 weeks, and I hope you'll keep listening. And thank you again for all the kind feedback about the first reading. I really do enjoy revisiting this material and this way of connecting with all of you folks. I hope you have a great week coming up. Talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.